Okay, this is Jane Poulin from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission interviewing Bill Isaac. Our topic today is accounting, the role of accounting during the financial crisis. And Bill, I appreciate you taking the time. Is it all right if I call you Bill?
Of course.
Okay.
I've been called worse things.
Oh, okay. And Bill, are you familiar with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission at all?
Sure.
Yeah, we understand that we're mandated to investigate causes of the financial crisis. And it's a temporary commission. We will be issuing our report December 15th, 2010. And would like to just talk to you generally about your thoughts on the role of accounting during the crisis. I know you have some particular thoughts on fair value or mark-to-market accounting. But if there are any other topics of accounting that you think are relevant to make sure we have on our list of things to consider, happy to hear about those as well.
Okay. Well, securitizations would be the other big thing.
Sure. So we can take whichever topics you want, but on securitizations, if you wanted to do that one first, what about securitizations?
Well, that was relatively simple. I think that the FASB made a big mistake in allowing the securitizations where the banks still have some exposure to be taken off bank balance sheets and escape capital requirements, and I think that helped lead to the over-leveraging in the financial system and the resultant crisis. So I think they made a mistake in doing that. I viewed securitizations generally as secured financings, and I think that that accounting treatment was incorrect accounting treatment. And then once the FASB recognized the error of its ways, it brought the securitizations all back onto the balance sheets beginning in 2010, which I thought was a mistake in the other direction, that those securitizations existed already. They were out there. The bank had whatever exposure it had. And to bring them back onto the balance sheets, rather than just saying that they were grandfathered, the previous securitizations could simply wind down. They brought them all back onto the balance sheet, and it had a countercyclical effect in the other direction because it chewed up bank capital at a time when we desperately needed banks to be lending money and helping borrowers. And instead, the FASB thought it was appropriate to bring all those back onto the balance sheet in one fell swoop, and then the bank regulators compounded it by imposing capital requirements on them effective immediately. So you can ask more questions, but that's sort of my spiel there. It doesn't need to go any longer than that.
So I'm going to ask a few questions because this topic comes up with others, so I'm trying to ferret out some kind of the nooks and crannies on this topic. So it sounds like your criticism is about, if you will, FIN 46 model and FAS 140 model that allowed, whether it's mortgage securitizations or anything all the way as exotic as the special purpose vehicles, for all that stuff to be off balance sheet, or is it only the ones where, for example, there were difficulties in the marketplace and sponsors such as an example, Citigroup, had CDO and CIV structures that they ended up ultimately taking losses on and or financially supporting those structures and then having to consolidate them back onto their balance sheet. So I'm trying to figure out, is it all securitizations or only ones where banks have, quote, exposure that we saw come through in the crisis? And then if it is just that smaller population, if you could talk more about what you think exposure is.
Well, that is a very complicated subject, and
sorry.
One that it is, and one that I'm not probably qualified to address. But let's just take as an example. I know that I talked to one bank that had a lot of credit card securitizations, and I said to the bank, I said, "What happens if?" These things are in trust, and what happens if the terms and conditions of the trust are not satisfied because there's an undue number of defaults by borrowers and the covenants of the trust are violated. What happens in that case? And they said, well, we won't let it happen. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, we'll put more, we'll take those bad loans out and put some good loans in. And because we can't afford to have a securitization fail, because if we did, we would never have another one. And we can't afford that. So, I mean, I take a look at that and I say, well, is there any legal exposure there? And the answer is no, they didn't have to do that, but they made it plain that that's exactly what they would do.
Right. So, some of the similar facts like that for some of the other things that entities consolidated onto their balance sheet. They didn't have a legal obligation to do it, but they chose to do it for exactly the reasons you're talking about, which you would think that would have been factored in when they were trying to determine whether it should be on or off balance sheet in the first place.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now we have the new model, FAS 166 and 167, which basically replaced FAS 140 and FIN 46, FIN 46R. And that's a different model, but just to talk a little bit about that, that model requires for a company to have to consolidate a trust, securitization trust or any other kind of trust, they have to have both significant economic exposure and decision making. So there's potentially room to structure around the new standard, in my estimation. And in some cases, I've looked at some of the big commercial banks, or I guess multi-diversified banks, and they still have a number of things that are not being consolidated because they don't hit both of those prongs. The mortgage securitizations, many of those were guaranteed by the GSEs, so then the GSEs are consolidating those. And some people have now say, well, geez, well, now when you look at the GSE financial statements, how meaningful is there to be, you know, a list of numbers and then this huge, you know, $3-4 trillion number on the mortgages, because now the mortgages are consolidated. So we tried to, the FASB tried to come up with a better model, but I'm not sure if it's perfect in the eyes of everyone who's seeing the results so far. But I actually, before 166 and 167 was finalized, I actually was curious to see whether it really would be finalized because of the capital issue that you raised, though. I mean, even if it's only $130 billion, if we can call that only a small number, that a bank has to consolidate, that's still requires a capital charge that would have been unanticipated prior to the new standard. So, it's generally the consolidation standard, but anywhere there would be exposure, and that includes not only legal obligation exposure, but reputational exposure.
Let's say it again.
Reputational exposure.
No, but leading up to reputational exposure.
Oh, so it's not just, it's the consolidation model generally, and your view is that if a bank has exposure, it should be consolidating the entities that it has exposure to, and exposure should include business risk or reputational exposure. Like you described.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
We won't let it fail because if we let this one fail, we'll never do another one.
it may be that what my concern is more focused on bank regulators than on FASB.
Okay.
Because maybe if there is no legal risk to the bank, they're not obliged to make the trust whole, that maybe that's good enough for the accountants.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of whether that securitization fee should be reflected on the bank's books or not. But if I'm a bank regulator and I believe there is significant risk there,
right,
maybe even if it's only reputational risk, then I ought to be looking at that in terms of what one area where I could be looking at it is in whether I'm going to make them maintain some capital against it.
Right, so how that's factored into the risk-weighted assets and what capital is required on it.
Right, and another way I might look at it is to simply say, this is so risky, I'm not going to let you do it. Or I'm going to consider those assets to be on the balance sheet. And so it may be more of a regulatory issue than an accounting issue, but it is an issue. But the reason I also would be concerned, however, as I said already, about changing the rules retroactively. You can't do that. It's just not if we want to get the economy going again. You can't. I mean, mark to market has destroyed over $500 billion of capital, and there is a shortfall of capital. And at the same time that exists, we're telling banks that several trillions of dollars of securitizations that are off the balance sheet and not included in the capital calculation, playing by the rules, are now going to be brought back on effective immediately. I mean, I don't see the point in that. The exposure is already there, whatever it is. And why not let those, why not grandfather those and just change the rules prospectively? Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm coming from.
Okay.
I don't know that I have any answers for it, but okay. I sure have some concerns about it.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is not a new concern. I've been concerned about securitizations for a lot of years because there's no free lunch here. You can't. Banks have to stand behind these things, or else they're going to be shut out of the securitization markets.
Right. Well, I guess, yeah, people would argue that if, for example, if we did something so extreme that it, quote, shut the securitization market down, then that would be problematic. I mean, I don't think we would have experienced the economic prosperity that we did in the last 20 years here, if that had been the case, if securitization was not a vehicle. Have you thought about that angle?
Yeah, say it again.
If you move from the extreme that we have now, which is off balance sheet treatment is available through the securitization process and the securitization accounting literature,
mm-hmm.
If banks weren't able to securitize and move mortgages off their balance sheet and they had to retain those for investment purposes,
mm-hmm.
Have you considered what kind of impact that might have on the marketplace?
Well, I guess what I was saying is that I would not do anything retroactively. The stuff that's out there, I would just let it sit until it winds its way down, and then I think we need to come up with some new rules for going forward. And I don't purport to know what those rules are because I think there are lots of different circumstances in these securitizations. Some you might say, okay, I don't see any serious reputational risk here. You've gotten them off. You have no, there's no recourse against you. You've certified you're not going to be buying any of these back, whatever. Whatever the rules are, and they're off the balance sheet. But the stuff that doesn't meet those tests is the new stuff is going to be on the balance sheet. And I don't have a problem with that. I mean, it means that banks are going to have to raise more capital,
right,
and more funding if they want to continue in that business, which probably means what? I mean, I don't know all the ramifications, but one thing it probably means is it's going to be more costly to maintain these securities, to make these loans and hold them, and therefore the pricing is going to change. That's probably a good thing. I mean, there's a whole lot of securitizations out there that blew up,
mm-hmm.
and helped lead to this crisis. We had way too much leverage in the system. Fannie and Freddie, look at all the securitizations they did. Things weren't properly priced. And there were assumptions made that there would never be any defaults. that housing prices could never go down. So maybe we need a test, a higher pricing and a greater dose of reality.
So when you talk about pricing, you're talking about the Fannie and Freddie guarantee pricing or mortgage pricing more broadly?
Probably both.
Yeah, okay.
Clearly mortgage pricing, at least on the higher risk stuff, was underpriced, right?
Well, arguably, if you securitize it and the securitization blows up, something was wrong.
Something was wrong.
Yes. Somebody didn't get paid enough along the way to make it work.
And I think that the reason why something went wrong is because nobody really thought, along this whole chain, nobody really thought they had any risk. Mm-hmm. And they really did have some risk. The banks were and their regulators were pretending like the banks didn't have any risk because they sold all this junk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was off the balance sheet, and they washed their hands of it. But that's not true. They didn't wash their hands of it. A lot of it's coming back. And the people who bought it, it got its AAA rating or whatever, and they thought they were buying an asset that didn't have any risk. And besides, everybody knows that the First National Bank of Oshkosh wouldn't sell bad stuff, right?
Ah, of course.
And so, I guess we all sort of deluded ourselves, I think, into thinking that this was riskless activity or the next thing to riskless, and we didn't price it right. We didn't price the product right, and we also didn't price the securities right that got sold.
Okay. I'm just writing this down. Okay.
I don't think any of that is particularly profound, and I don't think that it is. I think it's hard to argue against it. I think that what people will do is they'll say, "But if you do that, and then the sky's going to fall because nobody will have houses in America again." Right.
Right.
I mean, that's the answer that they're going to give. Nobody's going to be able to have credit cards if you do this. And we had credit cards and housing loans before we had securitization.
Right, but I bet you got 1/10 of the credit card application in the mail that you get now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what happened was we had I think we had a glut of it, and we clearly did. I don't think anybody can dispute that as a society, we got way over leveraged and way too many credit cards and credit card, balances outstanding, and way too many people bought houses that couldn't afford them.
Too much cheap credit.
And a lot of them were doing it for investment even. I mean, they weren't even living in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's true there will be less product if we do these, if we make these changes. I think it's important that we make the changes over time because there's going to be some real withdrawal pains. So we really need to make these changes carefully and over a prolonged period of time, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't do them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What bothers me is when people go jerking around from policy to policy. Let's take another one. I mean, this is again a bank regulatory issue, but the bank regulators put in place the Basel II capital rules, which I've been fighting for ever since they started talking about them. I testified before the Senate Banking Committee 3 times as a private citizen opposing the Basel II capital rules because I thought they were highly pro-cyclical and they were based on backward-looking models. What backward-looking models tell you is if everything's okay in the past, everything's going to be okay in the future.
Is that, are you particularly picking on the VAR?
The what?
The VAR analysis that's used for some of a lot of people use it for their trading book.
Those models may also be flawed, but what I'm really commenting on are the Basel II capital models, which which the regulators decided to use, the Fed and the Treasury promoted it, the FDIC was opposed to it, to break assets down into all, you know, to really granular proportions, to use modeling based on prior experience to determine what kind of risk weighting all these different assets should have, and therefore what capital should be applied against them. And that's very, I think that's similar to the value at risk models that people had come up with. But I'm talking about what the bank regulators were actually doing.
Right.
So
the additional granularity, the flip side of your argument would be, well, we went to additional granularity to better assess risk. So it sounds like what your solution be? Would your solution be more of a generic categorization or a flat rate?
Well, I very much lean toward a flat rate, and I believe that the models. I think the regulators need discretion to require more based upon I've been a strong proponent of having a much higher ceiling, but let me not get lost in the detail here for right now, because I just was trying to make a point. And that is that for years I've been opposed to the Basel II capital models because for a couple of reasons. One is I thought that they were highly pro-cyclical because they simply looked at past experience and then extrapolated that into the future. And if you have come through a period of a decade of economic prosperity, the capital models are not going to tell you you need much capital.
Right.
Because you haven't had any losses. Mm-hmm. And then when the bottom falls out, as it did in 2008, the models start telling you that they start screaming at you that you don't have anywhere near enough capital because of all the losses that are being generated, and so you weren't required by the regulators to put sufficient capital in during the good times, and they're requiring you to put way too much capital in the bad times because that's what the models are telling you, and you wind up with a highly pro-cyclical effect. If the boom was prolonged and was allowed to go to higher levels than it should, and the downturn becomes much more prolonged as well, because banks can't get out of it because they're trying to raise capital and they can't make loans. The other issue that I would raise about that is the other thing that Basel II capital models did is they started relying on capital, forms of capital that I don't have much faith in. I don't believe they really are available in times of emergency. For example, they would include in their permissible capital things like trust preferred stock and subordinated debt and the like. The only capital that ever meant much to me as chairman of the FDIC was tangible equity. If it's not tangible equity, I don't have much faith in it because it's not really there to be drawn upon in an emergency. And we found that out in this last crisis because the markets, that's all the markets wanted to know about a bank is what's its tangible equity. I don't care what kind of preferred stock it has. I don't care what kind of subordinated debt it has, because that's only relevant in liquidation. And what we're worried about is this bank is a going concern.
Got it.
And so they were just plain wrong in their approach toward capital. This was all promoted by the Treasury and the Fed over the objections of the FDIC. And then we get into the middle of the crisis, and what do the Fed and the Treasury do is they tell all these big banks, we don't care about all those other forms of capital now. You don't have enough tangible equity. So go raise more tangible equity.
Right.
In the middle of a crisis, go raise more tangible equity. So what are the banks going to do in the middle of the crisis? They can't raise more tangible equity very well. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to do is they're going to stop growing.
Right.
And if they stop growing, then the economic troubles are deepened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm talking about, is this... You know, you need sound policies, and you can't you can't change things overnight. When you do have a bad policy in place, you can't change it overnight. You need it without causing a whole lot of hurt. And so that's, I'm saying that happened in the securitization area. I think we had bad policies, and then we tried to change them overnight. In the capital area, we had bad policies, and they're trying to change those overnight. And that's not how you deal with the financial system. If you, assuming that you don't want to do any more damage to people's lives than you already have.
Okay. Well, thank you for all that capital insight, because that's a secondary area of my interest, as you might imagine with an accounting background. Actually, Bill, I'm sorry. At the onset of the call, I didn't ask you for your background. You have mentioned some of your previous history, but just for the record, if you could just give me a brief synopsis of...
I am a native of a small town in Ohio, Bryan, Ohio. I went to law school, my undergraduate school at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. I went to law school at Ohio State. Graduated summa cum laude in 1969. My first job was at Foley and Lardner law firm, a very large law firm. It was headquartered in Milwaukee, still is, I guess. I was there 5 years, focused primarily on banking, bank regulatory and merger and acquisition activity while I was there. That was from 69 to 74. My second job was at First Kentucky National Corporation, which was the largest bank holding company in Kentucky, headquartered in Louisville. And I was vice president, general counsel, and secretary. And those, I guess those things are, secretary and general counsel are pretty self-explanatory. In addition to those areas, I was in charge of investor relations as well as regulatory relations. And I was served on the Corporate Finance Committee. And then in 1978, I was appointed to the FDIC board by Jimmy Carter. At the time, the FDIC board was a three-member board. Now it's five. And it was a bipartisan board, meaning that all three could be from the same party. And I was appointed as a Republican to the FDIC board. I was 34 years old at the time. I served on the board for nearly 3 years. When Ronald Reagan was elected, I was named chairman of the agency. And I ran the agency from 1981 through the end of 85. So about 5 years I was chairman. My term was a six-year term. I went 2 years beyond the six-year term, because of all of the problems that we were having in the banking system, and that there was not a convenient time to leave. The 80s, as you know, was a period of enormous turmoil with some 3,000 bank and thrift failures. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the FDIC was given responsibility for cleaning up the S&L mess as well as the banking mess. That came after my time. That was 1989 when the FDIC was asked to clean up the S&L mess. But we had 3,000 bank and thrift failures, including many of the largest banks in the country. And I'm happy to say that we got through it all without creating a panic, unlike 2008. and then I left the FDIC at the end of 85. I became a partner at Arnold & Porter Law Firm.
Oh, okay.
And Arnold & Porter and I formed a consulting firm called the Secura Group. The Secura Group worked in, served financial institutions. It dealt with regulatory compliance issues and risk management issues and the like. We did that in conjunction with Arnold Porter owned 25% of it. Did that with Arnold Porter from 1986 until I think it was about 1992. When I bought Arnold & Porter out of the firm, sold a third of it to Arthur Anderson and Anderson Consulting, and they were involved in it for, I think, 3 or 4 years, and then that wasn't working very well, so I bought them out. And then Secura remained an independent firm until 2007, when it was purchased by LECG, an expert witness firm primarily. They do other things. And so LECG bought as the Secure Group in 2007, and I am right now the head of global, what's it called? Chairman Global Financial Services at LECG.
Oh, all right. So I am somewhat familiar with LECG.
I do other things, too. I was recently, just last Friday, I was elected to the board and chairman of the board, non-executive chairman of the board of Fifth Third Bank.
Okay. And so, just as for my personal interest, Secure Group is a separate little group within LECG, and I have been on the website, but it wasn't this morning, so I may have seen
that. Well, it used to be a separate little group, and it's more integrated now. We actually don't use the name Secure anymore. For a while we used the Secure Group of LECG, but we actually market solely under the LECG brand now.
There is
a financial services group within LECG, and the former Secure people actually run that.
I see. Okay. And so it's advisory that cuts across multiple disciplines in the industry of financial services, or is it particular disciplines?
Well, there's a lot of regulatory consulting work.
Oh, okay.
Bank wants to, it gets in trouble with the regulator, we go in and try to help solve the problem, or the bank wants to do something new and different, and they need to talk to the regulators, convince the regulators it's an okay thing to do. We get involved in that kind of stuff. We do a lot of risk management work, showing the bank how to better organize itself and put proper controls in place so they don't lose their shirts.
Okay, so bank regulators and risk management, not SEC regulator, though. That would be maybe other people. Anyway.
There are people in LECG who are involved in the SEC, including Lynn Turner, who used to be the chief accountant. But they are, that's not what
financial services is.
They might even technically be in financial services, but that's not what. I think they actually are a separate unit. But in any event, I don't know much about what they do.
Okay. Anyway, just trying to figure out how you fit into LECG. Very interesting background. Okay. So, fair value accounting. Do you want to move on to that topic?
Okay.
So you specifically point to FAS 157 as one of the culprits in the crisis.
Let me give you a preface.
Okay.
As well, by saying I think I've said this in my testimony before the SEC and for Congress. I'm not an accounting expert. Never hope to become one.
Oh, lucky you.
I only got involved in this subject because I believe, well, first of all, when I was at the FDIC and we had the savings bank crisis, which is similar to the S&L crisis, except it was in the FDIC's realm because we insured the savings banks.
Right.
I actually looked seriously at whether we should do mark-to-market accounting for, and by the way, I never use the term fair value accounting because I don't think there's anything fair about it, and I don't think it reflects value very well either. So I always have preferred to do market value accounting or mark-to-market accounting. I think fair value is a misleading label for what these guys do. But when I was at the FDIC, I actually toyed seriously with the possibility of imposing mark-to-market accounting on the savings bank industry, on the theory that it would force them to match their liabilities and their assets more closely.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that one of the problems is that the savings banks had these deposits that were short-term in nature, funding a lot of long-term and fixed-rate investments in loans and in government securities and the like, and so there was a real mismatch in these savings banks. And when interest rates went up to 21.5% in beginning in 1979, the savings banks deposit costs went way through the sky, and they were invested on the asset side in long term fixed rate assets, and so they were just hemorrhaging red ink all over.
Mm-hmm.
And my theory was that if we put mark to market accounting in place for the assets and the liabilities, that it would force these guys to match their book. And so I actually devoted a fair amount of time to considering it. And after about a year or so of debating it and studying it and everything, decided that it just was a bad idea. That what it would mean is that, first of all, it was very difficult to imagine how you could do it, because a lot of the loans didn't have an obvious market value, and I don't know how you mark the deposits to market value. For example, how do you value a checking account?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can be taken out on demand, so it has a value, but how do you determine it?
Mm-hmm.
with any sort of reasonableness, any kind of certainty to enough that you're going to run it through the financial statements. And so, to me, it was daunting to figure out how to make it work. And then the other problem was that who was going to make loans if we made everybody mark all this stuff to market? Why wouldn't they just take in short-term deposits and invest it in short-term investment securities?
Right.
Because that's safer.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Because then the FDIC would never have losses on a bank anymore, but because banks wouldn't fail because they all ran a matched book, unless they were incredibly stupid on their investment portfolio. We wouldn't have bank failures, but we also wouldn't.
We had some matched book companies who did fail, you know.
That's true. But, there's people find ways to do dumb things, but we might solve the FDIC's problem,
right?
Of bank failures. But we also would destroy the economy because nobody would be lending. And in fact, if you go back and look in history, in 1938, President Roosevelt convened the bank regulators and Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, and said, "Why it's 8 years into a depression, why aren't banks loaning money?" And we actually had market value accounting back then that had been imposed on the banking industry by the bank regulators. And they concluded that market value accounting was interfering with bank lending, and that we needed to get rid of it. So they did, and they put in place historical cost accounting to replace the market value accounting. And that was one thing they did to try to help get lending going and get out of the depression. Now, anyway, when the FASB decided to go back to market accounting in the early 90s, the reason why they did was because Richard Breeden, and this, by the way, this is all in my book.
Right.
But Richard Breeden, if you haven't read the book, he worked for Bush when Bush was vice president, and then he became, when Bush became president, he decided to clean up the S&L mess, and he put Richard Breeden in charge of creating the RTC and all that sort of stuff and getting the legislation done before Congress. And Richard did a great job. He and I are friends. And he did a great job getting the S&L mess on the road to recovery. And then he was made chairman of the SEC by Bush. And Richard Breeden had it in his head that the idea that I had about the savings banks, that if you should do mark-to-market accounting, and that'll force these people to carry a balanced book, blah, blah, blah. So he told FASB to put in market value accounting. And FASB resisted at first, as did all of the major accounting firms. And then Breeden got tough, and he said to FASB, said it publicly. I've been actually looking for the quote, and I can't find it, but I actually read about it at the time. I read it in the newspaper. At the time, I remember it well. He said to FASB, either you fix this and go to market value accounting, or the SEC is going to do it for you. So the FASB, which at that time was a more reasonable organization, not filled with zealots the way it is today, decided to go to mark-to-market accounting, but they got comments from a lot of folks, including the chairman of the Fed, Greenspan, the chairman of the FDIC, Bill Taylor, and Nick Brady, who was Secretary of the Treasury. They all wrote letters in 1992 saying, don't do this. It's highly destructive. They told them about the experience of mark-to-market accounting in the 1930s, and they said that Nick Brady was prescient in his comments. He said, if you do this, it's not going to reflect the business model of the banks, and it almost certainly is going to lead to a great deal of volatility in earnings and capital, and lead to severe credit crunches, which is exactly what it did this time around. So the SEC, the FASB was pressured by the SEC into doing this over the objections of the Fed, the Treasury, and the FDIC, and they went down this path. I've been writing about it for the past 20 years, saying it was a bad idea, and that we would regret it someday, and that day has come.
Okay, because that's my history.
It has nothing to do with accounting.
Okay, because a lot of people. Before I came here, you know, a lot of people would say in the press, something along the lines of FAS 157 is evil. But as you mentioned, fair value has been required for marketable securities since 1994, which I think is the standard that was written at the behest.
I have no trouble at all with mark-to-market accounting on the trading portfolios.
Right.
If you're actively trading securities and it's part of your inventory and you're showing trading profits and all that sort of stuff in that portfolio, I think you ought to mark it to market. I don't have a problem with that.
So then the other place mark-to-market comes into account is for the available for sale securities, but that charge goes through equity directly, and I understand that the bank regulators actually back that off when they consider the capital that the bank is holding.
It used to go through, I believe, the income statement. I think that they changed that to take it through other comprehensive income and be a capital charge in April 2, 2009. I may be wrong on that, but the Congress held that hearing in March of 2009 and put a gun to FASB's head and said, fix this thing or we're going to pick you.
So I think what it was is there's another convention that can cause things to be charged to the income statement, which is the other than temporary impairments, which is done via a fair value measurement. So I think it's the other than temporary impairments, and that model was changed for held-to-maturity securities, like held-to-maturity debt securities, in April of 2009. Yeah. So I understand. And so your beef isn't 157, it's more fair value generally, and back to when it originally came into play for securities back in the 90s. And then, so your view must have been that it's just a matter of time before we have some sort of hiccup in the marketplace. And when we do, the pro-cyclicality of fair value will come into play and impact bank regulatory capital.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay.
And I feared it would happen. It did happen. And it was just a matter of time. It had to happen. And now FASB has truly gone off the deep end, because they're not satisfied with the destruction they already caused. They've just come out with a new proposal that would extend mark-to-market accounting to the entire balance sheet of the banks.
Right, right. And it's got some complicated disclosure requirements, too.
Yeah. It's just stunning that they could be...
So, I'm happy to talk more about fair value accounting, but if you have more feedback on the FASB's process, that would be informative to me as well. Because here's one of the things. I hear folks like yourself complain about the exposure draft, the proposal to move more things to fair value accounting. And I'm curious, what's your view on how does the FASB get there? They have a process. They expose their what they're doing. They take comments from anybody who wants to provide them.
I believe that the problem is you have five people who sit on that FASB board who are not elected by any, you know, by the public in any way, shape, or form. Their process is rather secretive about how they get to those jobs, but I assume that the big accounting firms in the end control the process of who gets to sit on the FASB board. And so there's this mysterious selection process for these five individuals, and then they meet in periodically in Norwalk, Connecticut, and they make decisions that can have a profound effect on the economy, with no meaningful public oversight at all. The SEC is supposed to have oversight authority on them, but almost never exercises it, except in 1990 or 91 when Richard Breeden put a gun to their head and said, "Do something about fair value accounting." But apart from that, as near as I can tell, the SEC provides no meaningful restraint on FASB's activities. So there's just no public input. The Secretary of the Treasury, the head of the Fed, and the head of the FDIC had no influence on FASB in 1992. And I just think that's wrong to have private citizens with that much power. Now, on this latest thing they put out, it was a 3-2 vote. So you have three people that are able to basically shut down lending in the country if they choose to, and as near as I can tell, they're going to choose to. If they put it out, I can't imagine why they put it out and take all the heat they're going to take, and if they didn't really seriously intend to do it. Last thing FASB needs right now is gratuitous controversy. So I think they really are serious about it, and that's really scary, because even putting it out, I think, is going to make banks reticent to lend. If I were running a bank, I would say, wait a minute, I'm going to have to mark this loan to Granny Smith to market. How do I do that? Mm-hmm. And why would I bother? Why should I take that risk? Why don't I just go buy some investment securities, some government bonds or something?
Right. I mean, it doesn't even... I've been a preparer in various different capacities, and one of the things I always think about is like the volume of transactions that have to be dealt with, and certainly there's automated systems, but still the complexity of fair valuing a loan and there's huge volumes of them, and they're all, you know, there's some generic categorization you can do, but there's still like one-off transactions, and there's peculiarities to each one of those. So it seems like, you know, a record-keeping nightmare from a preparer's perspective. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how could the FASB so it sounds like the board process, how people get on the board, is potentially a problem. Influence from the big four firms. Are there ways the FASB could do a better job assessing the impact from their standards, like cost benefit, market analysis, or are there better things the FASB could do to really get input from users and preparers?
Well, probably all of those things.
Well, yeah, I kind of fed you that. But do you have any ideas along those lines?
Well, one of the things I thought that was, I've been saying that I believe that FASB ought to be subject to some form of government oversight, and meaningful government oversight, not just the SEC that doesn't monitor FASB any better than they monitored Madoff. And so I think that I'm trying to think of
the person or the entity or group of people that would oversee the FASB would have meaningful advisory or veto rights, and they'd actually use them.
I'll give you the specific of what I've been advocating, but the International Accounting Standards Board.
Oh right, I remember seeing that in your paper.
Is subject to oversight by the European Union, and I don't recall right now who exactly looks over them, but the IASB has to send its rules through. I don't know who it is, but they send their rules through some sort of a European Commission.
I don't know if it's the European Commission. I think it's the European Commission. I mix up whether it's the European Commission or the European Union, but I think it's the European Commission.
I think it is. I think it's the European Commission looks over and has to approve the IASB rules. What I've been proposing in this country is that if we have a systemic risk council, which both the Senate and the House bill are calling for, that council ought to have the ability to look at FASB's rules, accounting rules, and major policies to see if they are going to have serious adverse systemic effects, or might have serious adverse systemic effects, and if so, they comment to FASB and try to get FASB to address those issues. And if FASB doesn't address them properly, in the end, the Systemic Risk Council can overrule them. Now, until the FASB came out with its latest proposal, that bothered a lot of people. What I would like to see done, because they felt that the Accounting Standards Center should be completely independent.
Independent, yeah.
Completely independent. There should be no oversight from the government, which I don't understand, but. Some people, probably a majority of the people, do believe that for some reason. And so what they did in the House is Perlmutter put in an amendment to do what I proposed. It got watered down, so now the House version of the bill says that the Systemic Risk Council can comment to FASB about any rules that it's putting out and say that we think that could have a serious systemic effect, but FASB can ignore the comment. It doesn't have to respond to it or address it. Now, people who are in my camp are mollified by that, because they think that if the Systemic Risk Council comments publicly that something could have an adverse systemic effect, that FASB will surely give in and correct the problem. I'm not so sure, because they ignored letters from the chairman of the Fed, the chairman of the FDIC, and the Secretary of Treasury in 1992. What makes us think that they're going to listen to those folks now? So I would like to see it stronger than that. The Senate bill doesn't have anything about this in it. And so I don't know what comes out in the Senate-House compromise. But I can't believe it's going to be stronger than the watered-down Perlmutter amendment, and therefore I don't think we've really fixed the problem.
Okay, so yeah, FASB has too much power. I heard that somewhere else recently.
Well, they
too much
clearly
power
do.
For a group of private citizens.
They clearly do.
Yeah.
I mean, and the other thing I haven't mentioned yet is, I said originally the accounting firms were opposed to fair value accounting or market value accounting. Now they're all in favor of it. And I'm trying to figure out why they're in favor of it. I've talked to them and I say, why are you in favor of it? And they say, well, because it's the right way to go or something. I mean, they really don't have very good thinking on it.
I think they must be in the same camp as the FASB, so they think theoretically that's a better presentation.
I've got two better explanations, because it's clearly not better presentation.
Okay.
It's clearly not better presentation. And one theory, and I think both these theories are true, by the way, one of them is that the accounting firms are regulated by the SEC, which oversees the PCAOB, and the accounting firms do not want to take on the powers that be. Because, you know, these guys can cause them all sorts of trouble. If they annoy the SEC, they got problems. And clearly the SEC and FASB are in the same camp together. So I think the accounting firms politically have decided that there's no point in fighting City Hall. There's only trouble if you do that. The other issue for the accounting firms is that they got sued by my old agency and others for billions of dollars following the banking crisis and S&L crisis of the 1980s. And they had to pony up a lot of money. Arthur Anderson, I think, settled a bunch of claims for, I don't know, the better part of $1 billion or something. EY put up tons of money and so forth. And I think they've decided that rather than being sued and being held liable for as a guarantor of a balance sheet for saying what these assets are worth, they'd rather not have that responsibility. That if you mark it all to market, then they're not saying what those assets are worth. The markets are. Therefore, they can't be held liable because all they're doing is taking market prices and reflecting them in their financial statements.
That's an interesting angle.
It is. I mean, and I think it would be a hell of a lot better for the country if we gave the accounting firms better protection against liability, saying that they don't have liability unless they've done something that was, you know, whatever, willful. Mm-hmm. Willful malfeasance or some kind of a standard like that. They don't have liability. Rather than distorting the accounting system and the economy in order to limit their liability.
Okay. So the ambiguity of the valuation of fair value is a liability shield for the big four.
Yeah, I mean, because particularly, I mean, you know, they're going to the loans now.
Right.
I mean, what's a loan to Granny Smith worth? And an accountant, if the accountant has to certify that statement, the accountant goes in, looks at it, and says, "Well, does Granny Smith have a job? And what's she make? And what are her assets? And how likely it is she's going to pay it? And what's the exposure to future interest rate risk and all this?" And they make a judgment about at what value that should be carried on the books. And that is the reasonable way to go about it. But when you go about it that way, in fact, it's the only way to really go about it, because some trader in New York doesn't know what that asset is worth, and they all act as a herd anyway. They're either gung ho and they're bidding up at things, or they're turn off on it and they sink things. So that really is the only proper way to go about it. But if you're an accounting firm and you're having to make that analysis and those judgments, then you are exposing yourself to the fact that somebody will sue you if you're wrong, if subsequent events prove you wrong. It could have been good analysis at the time, but then they say, well, you should have known that housing was going to crater, that there was a housing boom, and you should have factored that into your equation. So now the accounting firm doesn't have to do that, because they just say, well, the computer screen says this, and that's all I'm obliged to do.
Well, that's interesting. I'm going to have to noodle on that a little bit.
Now, you were talking about clarity. I would tell you that I was speaking to the CFO of a top 10 bank maybe a month ago.
CFO or CEO?
CFO. In other words, somebody who knows what he's talking about. And I said, I'm trying to get a handle on how much money was destroyed, how much capital was destroyed in the banking system by mark-to-market accounting. And he's, long conversation. He said, I can tell you what happened in our bank. And I said, okay. So he was telling me what happened in his bank. I said, what about the other banks, the other major banks? What can we add it all up? And he said, no. I said, why not? He said, because the mark-to-market rules are so complex that I can't look at another bank and know what they did. I can't analyze another bank. Here's a guy that's the CFO of one of the top 10 banks, and actually an upper echelon top 10 bank, who says, I can pretty well tell you what mark-to-market did to us, but I can't look at another bank and tell you what it did to them. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
I mean, you ought to be able to look at another bank, if you're a bank, and analyze it.
The disclosure is more complicated after the April 2009 change. And I can understand why. I haven't tried to approach it from this perspective, but the disclosures got more complicated. And sometimes you feel you need to talk to somebody that actually prepared them to understand them.
The other thing I'd point out is the kind of crazy counterintuitive results you get with mark-to-market. In the first quarter of 2009, I believe it was the first quarter of 2009, Morgan Stanley's bond prices went up by about $1 billion because people were beginning to feel more comfortable with Morgan Stanley that it wasn't going to fail. In that same quarter, Citibank's bond prices went down by $1 billion because people were becoming increasingly uneasy with Citi and whether it could survive. There was talk of nationalization and so forth. Now, me as a simple guy from Bryan, Ohio, I would look at that and I would say, Morgan Stanley's bond prices are going up. People must think more highly of the company. And so it must be doing better. And Citibank's bond prices went down by $1 billion. People must be concerned that the company's doing more poorly and its future's not very bright. And so an accounting system probably ought to reflect that in some way. But what mark-to-market did was it added $1 billion to Citicorp's income and capital because it now had the ability to repurchase its bonds for $1 billion less.
Mm-hmm.
So its liabilities went down.
Right. This is the... You know, what used to be the dirty little secret about fair value, but is much more well known now, which is when you measure liabilities at fair value, when your credit rating deteriorates, you actually book income, which is, very counterintuitive.
And Morgan Stanley, on the other hand, got penalized by $1 billion because its bonds were now more attractive. And I got to tell you, an accounting system that produces that result, it's just seriously bad.
I know this. I think this is still on the FASB's list to deal with, but I don't know what their current prevailing views are, other than what's already in the the literature. Which, yeah.
And I feel a lot better. The other thing I tell you is that I don't know if I still have this in my computer. Let me look. Two things I want to tell you. One is that I believe that every major bank, including Citigroup, which was as troubled as any, that every major bank made it through the crisis cash flow positive, meaning that if you look at their income on a cash flow basis, they never lost money. Despite charging off $500 billion on a mark-to-market basis. In other words, mark-to-market was not reflecting at all the reality of the enterprise. Here's the other thing that I do have it in my computer. This is the year 2008. Banks this is the top, most of the top 35 or 6 banks. There's one missing here, bank number 9, 11. There's several missing. So let's just say the top 30 or so banks, 35 banks, had net income. This is for calendar 2008. They had net income before taxes of negative almost $48 billion. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's before tax net income, negative $48 billion. They paid taxes that year of $22 billion. Now, what does that tell you?
A lot of non-cash stuff.
Yeah. they had large, relatively large, positive cash income because they paid $22 billion in taxes. Mm-hmm. And they didn't do that because they were nice people.
Right.
The tax code is based on what is your cash income. And they had a whole bunch of charges, mark-to-market charges, I assume, that the IRS ignores when assessing them. I mean, I can send you that if you want to look at it.
Do you have all the banks listed?
Yes.
That would be helpful to see that.
All right, I can send that to you.
I'm not at my desk, but I will get it.
Do I have your email address?
Yes. Yep, because you sent me these other things.
Okay. What did I send you already?
You sent me your remarks on mark-to-market with the SEC.
Did I send you two charts?
I don't think there were any separate... Well, oh, yes. There's two charts attached to your letter, May 6, 2010, to Senator Bob Corker.
Okay. That's the other thing I was going to send you right now. But you already have it, so I don't need to. And what those charts show you is how temporary the asset, the decline in asset values were.
Mm-hmm.
That this was silly that we hit banks so hard with these losses, and they had to announce their, you know, these stunning quarterly losses, and they were going broke and all this sort of stuff. When what we had was a very temporary deflation of values because of the panic.
Do you have these in color by any chance? Because this one with the cumulative price changes by asset class, I'm having difficulty distinguishing which line is which.
They were in color.
They're black and white on the copy that I have. Oh, you know, it's how I printed them. I'm sorry. You already emailed these to me. I'm being stupid. Sorry about that.
I don't. You know,
yeah, you sent them to me. You didn't. I'm sorry.
How do you spell your last name?
P-O-U-L-I-N.
Okay. I don't see you in my address book.
Okay.
I think what I did.
You replied to me.
I replied to you and didn't put your... So let me see if I can find...
I can just give it to you.
Okay, go ahead. Oh, wait a minute. Let me get the create new thing here, new contact. Okay. It's Jane.
And it's J-P-O-U-L-I-N.
Well, wait a minute. Your name is P-O-U-L-I-N, right?
Right.
And now your email address is J... P-O-U-L-I-N?
Right.
At?
F-C-I-C.
F-C-I-C.
.gov.
.gov?
Yeah.
Okay, now I've got you in my address book, and I'll put down your phone number, too. 202.
I'm going to give you my cell phone, because it's very close to my office phone, so I always forget my office phone number. 202.
Uh-huh.
669.
Mm-hmm.
1386.
Okay, now I've got you there, so I'm going to I'm going to send you right now that list of banks and their taxes.
Great. And I just have to reprint this chart. I'm sorry. So I can read it better. Okay. So, was there anything else that...
No, I don't have anything else. If you don't,
okay.
I really do appreciate you, what you're doing, and I'm very, very unhappy with the Congress and their... I mean, I think they have not addressed any of the issues that led to the crisis. These are just political documents to try to atone for the TARP legislation they passed.
So, and what would be your top three things that they didn't address they need to address? We may have talked about them. I just want to.
Well, number one, we have a regulatory system that has led us into three major banking crises in my professional career, 1972 to 74, a very severe real estate crash that almost took down a whole bunch of major banks, but and then, of course, the crisis of the 1980s and the latest crisis, and I believe our regulatory system is highly politicized, inefficient, ineffective, and needs to be reformed. When Senator Dodd came out with his proposal last November to consolidate federal bank supervision, bank and thrift supervision into a new financial institutions regulatory authority, I endorsed it. I think that that's exactly what we need to do. And in addition to that, we should have a systemic risk council that is truly independent, staffed with, headed by a presidential appointee or a board of presidential appointees, however we want to do that. What they've done is they've created a systemic risk council and put the agencies that it's supposed to be overseeing in charge of it.
Well, yeah, because I was going to follow up. I thought now what we effectively have is it's like a consortium of the regulators that currently exist.
Exactly.
It's not a separate independent.
No.
There may be staff there, but I don't know how there would be. There's not a separate.
Well, no, the Treasury is going to supply the staff.
Okay. So then the council, if you will, the board or the commission is going to be, those seats will be filled by people who are at, I don't know, the Fed, the OCC, the SEC.
The people who brought us Basel II and so forth are going to be running the Systemic Risk Council. And they're supposed to be commenting on what their agencies are doing. I can't believe somebody really thought that was good governance. If a bank, it's equivalent to a bank saying to the organizing itself so that the lenders, the people who make lending decisions, are also going to be staffing the in charge of the risk control functions of the bank. It's the same thing. And we would obviously go ballistic if we saw that happening in any bank. And we go to great pains to make sure that there is an independent risk control system. And yet our government decides, our Senate and our House of Representatives decide that that is good governance. And the bank regulators are in cahoots. I mean, they're the ones who are endorsing this. And so there is no effective oversight. That's on the regulatory front. The next thing that the bill doesn't address is Fannie and Freddie at all. And I don't think there's anybody who would say that Fannie and Freddie didn't play a major role in bringing us the crisis. I mean, not be the phone calls, but they sure played a major role. Senator Corker presented a bill and an amendment in the Senate to impose on Fannie and Freddie the barest minimum of underwriting standards, and the amendment was rejected. So there's no attempt to deal with Freddie and Fannie and the problems they created. The third thing is that there's no attempt to deal with the myriad of highly pro-cyclical accounting and regulatory rules. There's no attempt to bring the SEC under any kind of supervision by the Systemic Risk Council or whatever. No attempt to upgrade the SEC. Clearly, the SEC made major blunders in this crisis, and leading up to the crisis, there's no attempt to control FASB, which I think was clearly responsible. So those are all things that the bill doesn't do that I think it must do if we're going to have an improvement in our regulatory structure and some hope of avoiding a future crisis. On the other side, these guys are so hung up on this whole too big to fail thing that they're emasculating the FDIC and the Fed in their ability to control a crisis. The Fed is going to be, I mean, in the 80s, we couldn't have gotten through it if the FDIC couldn't have had discretion to do some unusual things when, from time to time, when called upon, like rescuing Continental Illinois and not letting it go down and cause an international failure of the financial system. The Fed clearly did the right thing in keeping Bear Stearns from going down. And they should have done the right thing in keeping Lehman from going down to try to stabilize the system. And what the Congress is doing is taking away the authority of the Fed and the FDIC to act in a crisis, to prevent that crisis from getting out of hand. And it almost guarantees that taxpayers are going to have to be called to help the next time around because the Fed and the FDIC can't. So those are the major things I see that are wrong with the bill. And I see very little good in it. It's probably good that they're putting at least the standardized derivatives on an exchange,
yeah.
And the Volcker rule would be a good idea, except I think they're going to gut it, and it's not going to get accomplished much. I would be in favor of going back to the 1999 version of Glass-Steagall and putting it back in place. I thought we could regulate these large firms. I think they are way too complex for the management to manage them and for the regulators to regulate them. And I think we ought to go back to separating the investment banks from the commercial banks.
That would deal with some of the too big to fail issue.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the short term.
Mm-hmm. But Congress is not in a mood to do any of that. They're in a mood to... I would tell you that I was very disappointed that they decided to get ahead of you guys and do a bill to reform the system when there's a congressionally authorized commission to find out what went wrong.
Right.
How can you legislate before you know what went wrong? Unless you don't care what went wrong. And I don't think they do.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're under siege because of their vote on the TARPs, which was a very bad bill, should not have been enacted, and Senator Bennett lost his primary because of it, his vote on it, and he's an otherwise pretty good senator probably, and he's not in my state, so I don't really know what kind of senator he is, but I thought he was always pretty popular, and he got tossed out because of TARP. And I think these guys are running for cover, and they want to pass something. They don't care what it is. They just want to say they beat up on Wall Street and reform the system.
Mm.
So that's a long-winded way of saying thank you for what you're doing, and I hope someday somebody will listen to it.
Well, it's just interesting to get all perspectives. We aren't really working on, you know, legislation, but if there's things that you thought weren't addressed in the legislation that kind of strikes of those are problems you perceive that exist that may be outside the pure accounting stuff.
Yeah, well, there is nothing in the, almost nothing in the bill that really addresses the crisis and how we got there. And I think there's almost nothing in the bill that is going to prevent the next one.
All right. Well, Bill, I'm just going to end the call, but hang on for just 1 second. I'm going to sign off on the call here. Stop that.